Welcome to Shares from the American College of Financial Services, where money meets minds. Here's a look at what we'll be sharing with you today.
Tax policy changes more quickly than almost any other type of legislation, which means as advisors, it's more difficult to stay on top of our games, but it's also that much more important and that much more value we can provide to clients when we do it and do it well.
I'm Michael Finca, director of the college's Wealth Management Certified Professional Program, and your host for this conversation on specialized knowledge. We're joined today by Jeff Levine, Chief Planning Officer at Buckingham Wealth Partners and an expert on tax planning. Jeff, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
It's good to be back, and good to see you again, Michael.
Likewise, Jeff. Now, Jeff, one of the things that we've never talked about is how did you originally get into this field of tax planning? It's not something most kids dream about when they're young. So take us through the path that drew you to tax planning.
You know, I think before we started chatting here on recording, Michael, you told me we were going to have, you know, a limited amount of time. Do you have 4 days to meet?
I do, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, okay. The truth of the matter is, like you said, pretty much like everyone else, I did not imagine myself a tax specialist growing up. I always thought I'd be a doctor. That was kind of my path. And then sort of through a series of weird events and happenstances, I ended up in the tax planning world working for Ed Slot & Company. And the interesting connection there is actually my mother is the managing partner of Ed Slot & Company. So for years, everyone who knew that just thought I was working at a place where, you know, mommy works. But it was really, I had started in a financial advisor's office and was not really sure what I wanted to do as I grew up, if you will, right? I started in a financial advisor's office. It turns out that a change in direction was necessary and was trying to decide whether I was going to start my own company or whether I was going to join another company. And Ed sent me off to an advisor who was a great advisor, had a lot of experience, but had just written a book. And he said, you know, hey, I'd love to chat with you and give you some advice, but I just can't meet with you tomorrow. I've got my book signing. Do you mind if I meet with you the next day? And I said, like, sure, yeah, that's great. Thank you so much. I appreciate, you know, like, wow, 2 days later, it's amazing. And so before he hung up the phone, though, I asked the question that, in my estimation, really changed the course of my life. I said, do you mind if I ask what your book signing is? Just thinking, hey, if I take an interest in what he's doing, he's, you know, it's only fair to do that if he's taking an interest in me and my time. So I went the next night, I introduced myself, I bought a copy of his book, had him sign it. And then I went home and I said, you know what, I'm meeting with this guy tomorrow. I want to show him I'm a serious person. I'm going to read this book cover to cover tonight, all night, stay up. And I did it. And it was an awesome book, but I found like these three or four super esoteric IRA mistakes inside the book. And I called Ed the next morning. I said, Ed, I don't know what to do. Do I tell the guy he's got mistakes? And Ed's like, no, not this person, not this advisor. There's no mistakes in this book. I said, Ed, I'm pretty sure. I've kind of listened to you. I've got osmosis going on here for years. There are mistakes. And no. Finally, I faxed him the pages and he called me back a few minutes later. He goes, son of a gun, you're right. Why do you know that? And I said, Ed, I told you, I've been listening to you for like 10 years. Doesn't everyone know this stuff? He said, no, this is really like deep in the weed stuff. And so, you know, a few weeks later, I was asked to come up and meet with him in the office in New York. And he said, how would you like to come work with us here at Ed Slot & Company? And, you know, we need some young blood to infuse the office. And you seem to have a passion for this sort of stuff already. And it'd be great to have you on board. And, you know, my two concerns about it were, one, I love being a financial advisor still. And Ed was so kind and gracious to say, hey, you know what, you can still do that if you want. It'll just be in addition to what you have to do with us. But if you can do both, more power to you, and good luck with that, right? And so if you have to write an article for us, you can do whatever you want. Just don't schedule it while you have to do a client meeting. All right, that worked. And my other concern was I didn't want to work somewhere where everybody looked and just said, oh, you only have that job because of mommy or daddy or whoever it is, right? And Ed just said, look, you're right, that's going to happen, but you're going to have to be twice as smart and know twice as much to get half the credit as anyone else for a long time until they see that you can do it. And I just took it on as a challenge. I said, I'm gonna do it. And so that's what happened. And, you know, life made its way through, and I spent a good almost decade with Ed Slotin Company before kind of going off and separating to kind of continue to work on my own thing. And now here I am with you.
Well, I would say that you're kind of famous for that, aren't you? When a new piece of tax legislation comes out, I can always count on you to comb through all of the arcane details to pull out the stuff that doesn't really make any sense, that's probably going to get edited at some point down the road. Take us through that process. Like, what happens when you get a new piece of tax legislation?
Yeah, well, first off, I just love that. Like, that's like, you know, Christmas morning for me, unwrapping a new present or whatnot. I mean, just a new tax legislation means it's stuff that no one has ever seen before. You know, my problem, Michael, was that when I started really diving into this stuff, I was only 25, 26, 27 years old. And even though I was spending all this time going through these laws and regulations, there were people in the business who were doing that and who were really interested in this stuff, but had been doing it for, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years longer than I had even been alive. So the challenge for me was they were always ahead of me. Whenever something new came out that was like, wait a second, we're all on the same page here. Like, if I can get into this now, I can be just as good and smart and knowledgeable about this as anyone else. So that's kind of what really led to my just desire to get into the new stuff, is that I was on a level playing field with everyone else. And so now, you know, I would go through and I, you know, kind of pre-Twitter, I just start making notes and going through and building my own list of things to keep in mind. And then, you know, I don't remember how it started or whatnot, but I started making these obnoxiously long Twitter threads with my thoughts. And it served really a few purposes. One is I was going to have to put together my thoughts anyway. It was kind of a nice, logical way of going through and organizing it. Two, a lot of people would always ask, like, hey, what's in here? Or what's the important stuff? Well, it was right there. I could refer them to a place where I had all my initial thoughts kind of laid out there and bare. And the third thing it was quick. It was immediate. I didn't have to wait to write a long article. I didn't have to wait to be published in something. It was right there. As I was reading the law and figuring out things in my mind or seeing little things, I could kind of spitball out there. And sometimes people would write back and they'd say, you know what, maybe we don't see it the same way. Or, you know what, that's interesting. A good example would be in the last major tax update that we had on the retirement side, bill known as or law known as Secure Act 2.0. There was in the RMD section, there was a series of rules dictating when people in the future would have to start RMDs. And as I was reading through this, I said, boy, it sure seems like people in 1959 have to start RMDs at two different ages. Now, not have to take, but have to start taking. Obviously, you can't really do that two times. You can only start once. So I put out in this tweet, you know, hey, this kind of seems weird to me. I think there's an error here. And sure enough, a few moments later, I got a message from a reporter at a well-respected publication and said, hey, that's interesting. Can you tell me more about what you're seeing? And within a half an hour, they had already spoken to, you know, representatives of the people who were writing the bill and said, yep, you're right, that's a mistake. So, like, cool things like that, you know, like that always, and then, of course, I don't like anything to be boring. And taxes, I heard, not for me, but I've heard other people say that they're not interesting. So I tried to sort of couple the Twitter thread experience now with some sort of a gift-filled, that's GIF or JIF for some people, however you pronounce it, the GIF, right? The gift-filled some sort of a theme. So I've done The Simpsons one time. I've done pretty much every major show. Star Wars, we've done Star Trek, we've done a Family Guy. And so sometimes when I'm out in a live event, someone will come up to me and be like, hey, I remember that one. That was the Simpsons bill, wasn't it? And I was like, yep, that was the one. Yep, sure. So it's I just really enjoy doing that.
So, by the way, those are true works of art for any of us who are financial planning geeks. I cannot wait to read your threads, usually the next day, because you're up till 2 o'clock in the morning writing those things. They are spectacular. Now, let's talk about the Secure Act 2.0, because it's in the rearview mirror now, but what are your most important takes from that advisors you think haven't quite fully absorbed yet?
I know you asked about Secure Act 2.0. I'm actually going to take us even back further to Secure Act 1.0, the original, or for the younger people listening to the podcast, the OG version of the Secure Act, right? So the original Secure Act was passed in late December of 2019. And now as we sit here today, Michael, having this discussion, you know, we're 3-4 years down the road. You'd think normally people would have fully incorporated all that planning into, or all those changes into their planning. But we have to remember the reality of the world in which we live in and what happened, right? The Secure Act passed late December 2019. A few weeks later, the world sort of shut down, right? People weren't worried about, oh, what happens with my IRA anymore? People were worried, I don't want to die. And they shut themselves in their houses and for good reason, right? It was a terrifying time for so many individuals out there. Nobody knew what was going on. We were in this unforeseen pandemic that came out of nowhere. And so IRA planning and retirement planning wasn't the top priority for individuals. Just staying alive and being healthy and making good choices about one's health really were. So even now, as I go and speak to advisors, sometimes I sit down and say, hey, have you looked at how the original Secure Act, the so-called death of the stretch, and shortening that to 10 years, has impacted your clients, particularly those, let's say, with trusts, or with other beneficiaries who may have had 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, maybe even more to take distributions out, where now it's just 10 years. Have you fully explored that? And they go, well, not really. And I think there's this gap where, you know, we got so tied up then in pandemic-related legislation and information and guidance that not everyone has fully circled back to that impact. So that's one. Then we fast forward a few years and Congress gave us Secure Act 2.0, which is what you referenced, and there's a ton in there. I mean, it's almost 100 retirement-related provisions in Secure Act 2.0. It was like a grab bag. Everything that Congress ever wanted to put somewhere else that didn't have a place to put it, they kind of threw it into this bill. And there's a variety of different key takeaways. I think if we're looking at broad strokes, the two biggest things, and I guess when I say biggest, the ones that'll probably impact the most amount of people are the RMD-related changes again and the Roth-related changes. So to me, the RMD change, the change is not difficult necessarily to understand, right? We're changing the RMD age from 72, which is what it was from Secure Act 1, which it used to be 70.5, then it went to 72. Now we've gone to 73 and 75 in the future. So there's two more ages. Those this year who turn 73, they'll start RMDs this year. Those who were born in 1960 or later are going to have RMDs beginning at age 75 instead. That rule change is not particularly complicated. But what is important to recognize here is the second level impact, sort of the knock-on effects of these changes, right? Like not too long ago, 5 years ago, we had individuals were forced by the government, in essence, to begin to spread out their income over their lifetime, beginning at age 70 or 71, right? 70.5. So first year, second, or first half, second half, your birthday, but sometime around then. So you started at around 70 to have to spread out your income. And then when you died, your beneficiaries had the rest of their life expectancies to take those distributions. So lots of years on both ends. Now we have fewer years of required distributions and many few years of possible distributions afterwards. And I know a lot of people listening are probably thinking, wow, my clients, they're not going to, you know, well, my clients are the smart ones. They're not going to have all that income. They're not going to wait till RMD age. Well, actually, if your clients are high income and high net worth, they're the ones actually who are more at risk of this because the average American can't wait until they're 75 to begin drawing on their retirement because they need to eat. They need to pay rent. They need to clothe themselves, right? That's why even before when it was 7.5, it was estimated by the IRS that only about 20% at that time were taking RMDs based on their actual RMD calculation. Everyone else was just taking money because they needed it. Well, that was 5 years earlier. So fewer years of potential distributions, forced distributions during life, plus fewer years of potential distributions after death means a lot more money might be crammed into a lot fewer years for a lot of people, giving them much higher tax rates. And when it comes to tax planning, this is something I always repeat over and over. The winner of the tax planning game is not he or she who has the lowest tax bill in any one year, but he or she who can create the lowest lifetime tax bill. Or sometimes when we're talking about retirement accounts where there's no step up in basis, sometimes it's he or she who can create the lowest multi-generational tax bill. You know, and the second element, we talked about the RMD change. The second one sort of ties into it, which is Roth-related changes. There were several Roth-related changes in this bill. One of them was to create new SEP Roths and new simple Roths. Another one allows employers to put their matching contributions or profit-sharing contributions into Roth plan accounts for clients, where previously it had to go to the pre-tax side. So all of those changes I just mentioned together are new ways in which an individual can get money into Roths that they didn't have the opportunity before. They also eliminated required minimum distributions for plan Roth accounts. So they made those more attractive. And finally, beginning in 2026, it was supposed to happen sooner, but it got pushed back already. Beginning in 2026, high income individuals, that's those with more than $145,000 of wages in the prior year, will have to make their catch-up contributions, if eligible. They have to make them to the Roth side of the plan. They won't even be given the choice to make them to the pre-tax side. So take them all together. The bill makes Roths more available to individuals. It makes some Roths more attractive to individuals. And it actually dips the toe, if you will, into the waters of forced Rothification, meaning some people will have to use the Roth. And all of it brings me to my key point, which is, so many people say, can I trust the government to keep their word about the Roth IRA? Look, I don't have a crystal ball any more than the next person, but all of these things lead me to believe the answer to that is yes. Congress is not shying away from the benefits of the Roth. They're leaning into it full-throated because they like the Roth. It brings in revenue today. And yes, you might argue it's at the expense of people down the road and income down the road, but they don't care. They look at a 10-year budget window and it looks good in that 10 years. So if some other poor schlub in 20 years in Congress has to deal with the impact, well, that's their problem, but it looks good on the federal budget line today. So I think Roth IRAs are here to stay. I think clients can rely on the rules today for the amounts that they convert today. And I think conversions are more valuable today than they have ever been because you have more time during life in which you can do them without having to worry about RMDs. And whatever you leave over to your heirs, many of them will have a much shorter time to take it out. So spreading out that income voluntarily is the most effective way to reduce taxes for the most amount of people.
The American College of Financial Services, championing causes, connecting communities, delivering best-in-class applied financial knowledge and education
for the benefit of professionals like you and for the benefit of society.
Expand your opportunities at the all-new theamericancollege.edu.
Jeff, there's so much we can talk about on each of those topics. I mean, first of all, the 10-year stretch. This is something I think a lot of planners, one of the things that I think is underappreciated is what happens to the net after-tax return on that money after it gets given to your kids. So if the kids are your primary beneficiaries and you die in your 80s, the kids are probably going to be in their peak earning years. They got 10 years to spend the money at money down. You've created a huge tax burden for them. And, you know, we've got the TCJA expiration coming up. You know, some of these tax brackets, especially the top tax brackets, are going to go up. By the way, that 24% tax bracket, when we're thinking about Roth conversions, that is huge for a married couple. It is such an enormous, big, fat opportunity for Roth conversions right now, especially if the couple is still alive. I mean, right? your opportunities for Roth conversions are so much more generous when you have a couple as opposed to when you're single. Why not take advantage of that? And it's going to go up to 28%. And that's a pretty big percentage increase in the amount of taxation, the cost of turning your money into Roth assets. So that's something advisors should have been doing prior to this year and need to absolutely be paying attention to right now. Talk to me about what are some of the solutions for someone who is going to give the money to their kids, who has high earners that are the primary beneficiaries for their qualified wealth, what are they going to do with that money?
It's a great question. There's a lot of different approaches here. And what I often encourage advisors to do is to build their Rolodex of potential solutions, because each client or each IRA owner might have a different sort of strategy that may be best or not for them or for their beneficiaries. And I also think you can kind of further divide this sort of discussion into two categories. There's sort of proactive planning done by the actual IRA owner themselves, and then there is like the reactive, or what I often think about as like crisis planning by the beneficiary, right? Who's already inherited this account, they just got it, and now they've got to figure out what to do to minimize the tax. So maybe we'll start there, right, with the beneficiary. And I admit, look, Michael, we're fortunate, right? Like our crisis, we're talking here about crisis planning, quote unquote, for someone who might have just inherited $2 million, right? This is not the world's biggest crisis. Like, oh my God, I just inherited so much money. What do I do? Like, there are bigger issues. I recognize that. But in our world, it's crisis because it's immediate. It has to be done and dealt with. So for the beneficiary, there's really just sort of three different approaches that they can take. Approach one is sort of kick the can down the road for as long as possible. Just don't take anything, or take as little as possible, year one, year two, year three, year four, and take as much as possible sort of at the end of this 10-year window. Now, we don't yet know. The IRS is sort of wavering back and forth on whether some individuals may have to take RMDs during those 10 years, but that really doesn't impact this approach, right? The idea here is take as little as you have to during years 1 through 9, and then take a big distribution at the end of year 10. And there are a few people who might benefit from that. The first and obvious one would be Roth beneficiaries, right? If you are a beneficiary of a Roth account that is growing tax and penalty free, unless you're taking the money out because you want to spend it, you want to go on vacation, right? And you're going to consume the dollars, there is no reason to touch that account. Let it grow tax and penalty free for as long as possible. And then at the end of the 10 years, take it out. The second group that you might fall into that category is clients who are already at the top tax rate, right? If you say, I'm going to have to pay taxes at the highest rate. Well, if you're going to have to pay taxes at the highest rate then versus paying at the highest rate now, you're probably better off paying at the highest rate then. Now, unfortunately, there is a little bit of a wrinkle here, right? And you already touched on it, which is the expiration of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and taking perhaps our top rate from today's 37%, and if it expires according to plan, going back to 39.6%. So there could be a scenario where someone says, you know what, I'm at 37%, and we come up to the end of 2025, and they're looking and say, wow, if I don't take it now, it'll be 39.6% when I take it out. So better to take it today at 37 versus 39.6 in the future. That may be the case, but believe it or not, a lot of those individuals actually still may be better off holding the money inside the account and paying 39.6 down the road. Because we're not talking about here an IRA to Roth decision where afterwards and before both accounts have tax deferral. We're talking about going from a tax deferred wrapper to a taxable account, right? If those dollars are going to continue to be invested, if you pull it out at 37%, let's say someone dies today, right? That means you have 10 years after 2024. So 2025, 2026, 7, 8, 9, 2030, 1, 2, 3, 4, right? So by the end of 2034, all those dollars would have to come out under the 10-year rule if someone died today. If a high-income individual who says, you know what, I'm so fortunate, I will always be in the top tax bracket, next year approaches December 31st, they basically have to make a decision of, am I better off today taking this money, paying 37% on it today, but for the next 9 years, any interest, dividends, or capital gains I earn on this money will be subject to income tax? Or am I better off paying a 2.6% higher rate and basically buying tax deferral for 2.6% for another 9 years? And all of this, Michael, would come down to how much turnover do you have in your portfolio? How much interest are you generating? How much dividends are you generating? But the loss of the tax deferred wrapper has value there. Whereas if we're looking at a traditional IRA to Roth IRA, we don't have to account for that because both accounts have tax deferral. So this is a more nuanced discussion. And the final third group that I might throw in there to beneficiaries in terms of who might want to wait till the end. You mentioned the 24% bracket being a great opportunity for folks who might be around that. Well, the 24% bracket has a lot of what you might call bandwidth, right? It's big. There's like $150,000 of spread between the bottom and the top. Not everybody inherits a million, $2 million, $3 million IRA. Maybe mom and dad had $250,000 left and five kids. So each one got $50,000. Well, you might be still well within your 24% bracket if you let it grow for 10 years. And even if it doubles over that time, still might have enough room without pushing yourself out of that bracket. So those who inherit more modest accounts may still benefit from waiting until the end of that time. But that's all the group who should wait as long as possible. The opposite approach there would be someone who may have similar income over each of those years. They may want to spread out the income as much as possible. And there, the approach I take is to take your 10-year rule and try to make it an 11-year rule. Now, it's not going to change the entire world. We're not going to, you know, this is not going to be the thing that makes or breaks the client's retirement in all likelihood, but every little bit helps. So maybe wondering, how do you make a 10-year rule an 11-year rule? We don't get to rewrite the tax code. Remember, the 10-year rule starts in the year after the year of death. But Michael, as we sit here and record this, we're early in 2024. If someone died today, there's enough time to set up an inherited IRA and get money out this year. And that's year zero, effectively, of the 10-year rule. So we can spread that out over 10 years for the beneficiary. And then finally, you talked about individuals being at their high peak income years because maybe they're finishing working. Well, we can sort of strategically time around that. This would be like the third category of crisis planning. If we have someone who inherits, but they're 5 years away from retirement, maybe we have no distributions for 5 years, and then we tack on some, we spread it out, but only over the last 5 years. Or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe they just retired at 65, but at 70, they've got Social Security starting, and at 73, they're going to have RMDs kicking in. Maybe we spread it out, but only over the first 5 to 7 years or so forth. So that's our crisis planning. Then we sort of have to switch gears and say, okay, if I want to minimize this impact for my heirs, I want to be proactive today and say, I have worked really hard. I'm probably going to die with some dollars left in my account. What can I do to limit this impact for my kids or my grandkids or what other beneficiaries we have? Then there are a whole list of strategies we might start looking at there. So the easiest one would be pay the tax for them, right? Like just do it for them in the form of a Roth conversion. Do the tax conversion or Roth conversion today, pay the taxes, and then when they get it, they don't have to worry about it. They may have 10 years, but whatever comes out will hopefully be tax and penalty free. In a similar vein, some people might look to pull money out and buy life insurance with it if they're in a, you know, if they're healthy and if they have no need for those dollars during their lifetime, there may be an opportunity there as well. But typically we see more in the Roth conversion end and less in the life insurance. But again, both strategies sort of rely on, I'm going to take money out today, pay tax at my rate, so heirs, you don't have to deal with it at yours. Now, beyond that, we can look at sort of structuring beneficiaries a little bit differently. For instance, one of my favorite approaches is to stop treating all your kids equally so that you can treat them more equally in reality and to get more of them more money. So a good example of this would be, let's say one kid is a neurosurgeon and the other is a social worker in a school. Both incredibly important jobs, both doing great things for individuals and helping. And you, as a parent, you'd be proud of both of those kids equally. But we know the financial reality. The neurosurgeon is probably in a much higher tax bracket than the social worker from a public school. If mom and dad have IRAs and Roth IRAs, most of the time they say, I love my kids equally, so I'm going to leave all my, you know, I'll leave 50% of my IRA to each kid and 50% of my Roth IRA to each kid. Well, that's certainly one way to deal with it. But Michael, as an economist, I know you deal in net dollars. And as a tax person, I deal in net dollars. And we know those kids, if you leave it 50-50, aren't getting the same benefit. The child who has the lower income tax rate is going to end up with more net dollars. Now, mom and dad might say, that's fine. The kid needs the money more, and I want my kids to know that I view them equally. Okay, that's one way to go about it. But another way would be to say to mom and dad, look, we could figure out and estimate the tax impact on your kids, and you can leave a little bit more of the Roth IRA to your higher income, you know, child, and more of the pre-tax account to your lower income child. And at the end of the day, we can get them the same net dollars as each other. And here's the thing that the parents have to be made aware of, or mom and dad, whoever it is, the owners of the accounts, they need to be made aware that this does not hurt one child at the expense of the other. At the end of the day, there are three parties here. There's child one, in my example, child two, and the IRS. If we get rid of or we reduce the IRS's share any way, right? And let's just say in this way, by leaving more pre-tax account to a lower earner so they have a lower tax rate, if the IRS gets less, it means there's more of that pie left over for the other kids. We can divide it between them however we want with some simple math, but it means each kid can get more. So that's another way. Or we might just leave it to more people. Right? Instead, if I can't spread money out over more years, maybe I'll just choose to spread it out over more people. Maybe I name grandkids when I wasn't going to name them directly before, if they're old enough to be out of the kiddie tax. Or maybe I simply say, when mom dies, instead of leaving the money to dad, dad has more than enough money. I'm going to make mom, leave it down to the kids right away. Or maybe dad disclaims, right? So he pretends like he's already dead and it goes to the kids, giving them one 10-year window. And then when dad dies later on, there's another 10-year window. So we can spread it out over two 10-year windows as opposed to one. I mean, there's lots of other things we could talk about, charitable remainder trusts and so forth, but there's a whole list. As I said, really the key thing is building the Rolodex for advisors of solutions so that when you come across a client with a large retirement account, you're able to work through with them and figure out which of these strategies makes the most sense for that particular client situation and family.
So, Jeff, let's talk a little bit about how to position, because we're talking about how to get the most after-tax dollars from the money that you save. You built up this wealth, part of it is tax sheltered, part of it is taxable. Have we not, this is actually, I think, a benefit of the 10-year stretch, but have we not created a situation where you can feel more comfortable spending down your tax sheltered dollars? And is that not actually a good thing? Because that's the whole purpose. The government spends a lot of money to subsidize these accounts. Should we not actually be in a situation where we start viewing that money as money we can spend? And if that's the case, that really opens you up to what are the strategies that allow you to spend the most money from those dollars. But I see that as a psychological benefit. You start seeing your, you know, money outside of the IRA, the traditional IRA, as money that you're going to pass on. But within the IRA, you know, instead of having to feel bad about the RMDs, it's okay because that's money you're going to spend. You get more money. And by the way, I'm with you. I think actually RMDs are incredibly valuable for less sophisticated retirees because it gives them a guideline about how much they can spend every year. You know, I worry that they spend too little. I worry they spend too much. RMDs are actually a pretty efficient method for spending down assets. But by making it more tax efficient to just spend the money down and then leave the other money alone, isn't that really what we should be encouraging here, is just spend that money down?
So it's a really interesting question. I think the answer for a lot of clients is yes. So most of the people I run across, you know, when they're doing retirement planning, their person foremost, their goal is they don't want to run out of money before they run out of life. That's the most important thing for them. But then after that, most of them might have some legacy desires, like, hey, I'd like to leave my kids, you know, a couple $100,000 or whatever it is in the client's mind, $1 million. It's up to each individual. But most people don't have the idea or the goal of, I'd like to make sure I don't run out of money, and I want to sacrifice my entire retirement lifestyle so that my kids can get every last dollar, right? That is not typically what it is. It's typically, I want some amount for them, or sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's whatever else they get, is fine. And as advisors, we run these Monte Carlo simulations a lot, right? And oftentimes we see success and then we see failure. And we look at these rates and we go, oh, well, you didn't run out of money. That's success. Well, not always. A lot of times clients fail, but they fail to the good side. You know, they fail to the good side. If a client tells you they want to leave $1 million to their kids and to not run out of money during their lifetime, and they live a a normal retirement. Let's say they die at 95, so it's not like a shortened life expectancy. But they wind up with $15 million in the bank when they die. We have failed them as advisors in their retirement plan. They didn't want to leave their kids $15 million. They wanted to leave their kids $1 million and enjoy their retirement. Well, they could have enjoyed it a lot more spending that other $14 million. So to your point, yeah, I think we do need, in a lot of cases, to encourage people to have the comfort and the confidence to be able to spend the dollars to enjoy their retirement and then satisfy on top of that whatever legacy goals they have.
By the way, if you are more interested in this topic, read my latest article for Advisor Perspectives on exactly this topic, because I do think that, you know, if the goal is to wring the greatest amount of satisfaction from every dollar that you've earned over the course of your lifetime, let's be more deliberate about this process. And that means spending the money when that's your goal, passing it on when that's your goal, but you can lose the game of life by just not spending enough. And I think that part of this whole tax planning process, we can become too clever by half by thinking about ways to pass on dollars in the most tax efficient manner possible. But if that's not really your goal, then what's the whole point of it? You know, it's you've got to balance. Jeff, it's been wonderful to talk to you about retirement planning strategies. I think you need to come on the podcast again and we can start talking about estate planning, especially because we have to talk about ways to deal with the expiration of the TCJA. But this is a fantastic conversation. Much appreciate your time.
Of course, always. And I look forward to being back and talking about estate taxes. We've got a ticking time on that. And look, there's one thing we know, especially when it comes to taxes, where legislation can be passed via a simple majority vote in the Senate, via reconciliation, different from almost everything else, and that tax policy changes more quickly than almost any other type of legislation, which means as advisors, it's more difficult to stay on top of our games, but it's also that much more important and that much more value we can provide to clients when we do it and do it well.
And it gives us an opportunity to read another one of your tweet streams.
That's all for now, but you can find all our episodes on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and most other streaming services. Be sure to like us, follow us, and leave us a rating and review. Shares is a production of the American College of Financial Services, and we hope you join us next time as we share ideas that expand your opportunities.